Hey everyone, and welcome to Making It with Maggie, a community created for women who continue to live, maybe laugh, and definitely love as I share real life experiences as a human, mom, wife, and business owner. This podcast will include my background as a physical therapist and women's health coach to apply a variety of health and wellness strategies to this thing we call life. It's time to transform our motivations from passive self-awareness to an active aware yes. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for making it on this episode with Making It with Maggie. Today, I am very excited to have Brittany DeGrief with us. She is a board-certified genetic counselor, and I can't wait to discuss how we can be preventative in this, all of the things that we can be aware of. She is our main gal. So welcome, Brittany, and tell us a little bit about yourself and how your professional interest developed into genetic counseling.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Maggie, and nice to meet everyone. So I'm Brittany DeGrief. I'm a cancer genetic counselor. I'm actually the lead cancer genetic counselor at Northwestern Medicine in downtown Chicago. And I'd also like to say, too, that I'm here representing myself as an individual provider. And what I state here today are not necessarily representing the views of my employer. But so I got into genetic counseling. I actually didn't know about it until I was 4 years out of my undergrad. I was a biology major and kind of going the pre-med route, and had no idea genetic counseling existed, even though I took genetics in high school and college. I went back to my college genetics course and actually found a single slide on genetic counseling as a career. So not much exposure about it. The way I stumbled into it actually was actually through a family experience. But my mom was diagnosed with ovarian cancer when she was pretty young. She was 49. And during her diagnosis, the doctor felt like this was kind of an odd presentation of her being so young with such an extensive disease. So they ended up doing genetic counseling and testing for her, and she tested positive for BRCA1. And so since she was diagnosed with that, it was recommended that my sisters and I all went and did genetic testing because there was a 50% chance that we could have carried that, that would predispose us to develop certain cancers. And then afterwards, meeting with a genetic counselor for my family, I actually reached out to the genetic counselor and said, "Hi, this is a really interesting field. Can you tell me more about it?" And that genetic counselor kind of changed my life professionally because she introduced me to this whole world. So I ended up applying to graduate school. I went to Northwestern for my master's in genetic counseling. Afterwards, you know, you get certified in everything. So I just ended up choosing oncology because I think that was the area where I felt most comfortable in and could relate to patients the most in a way through my personal story. And I haven't looked back ever since. But if any point in time I ever wanted to switch gears and focus in another area, the nice thing about genetic counseling is I can always go practice in another area such as cardiology risk or prenatal or other sorts of patient-facing genetic counseling roles.
Well, first and foremost, thank you for sharing your story. I know this, it can be challenging. It can be motivating in some ways and other ways it obviously challenging. So I appreciate you sharing your experience because I'm sure a lot of others have had similar experiences too. And then in addition to that, I feel like there's a big oncology focus nowadays too. And just recognizing that genetic counseling can just go beyond oncology also. Yes, oncology. You know, the big talk is cancer treatment. And growing up, there were like three cancers. It was breast cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer. And now there's so many different forms, different presentations. And so it'll kind of be nice to pick your brain on it a little bit today too.
Yeah, definitely.
So being a specialist in evaluating individuals for the BRCA variant, what are some of the screening and prophylactic recommendations you commonly use or apply?
Yeah, so I think BRCA is just one of the common conditions that we see, but it's definitely not The only common one, there's also another common one called Lynch syndrome. And it's estimated that about one in 275 or so individuals, and any GI counselors that's hearing that listens to this may or may not agree with those percentages, but it's more common than we think. But many individuals actually might have Lynch syndrome and not know it, and that condition predisposes to colon cancer, uterine cancer, ovarian cancer. The BRCA genes predispose to breast and ovarian cancer, but also prostate cancer, male breast cancer. So when we think about identifying these types of conditions in individuals, really what we're looking for are clues in families. And so this could apply to any genetic genetic oncology risk assessment. And so that's usually young ages of onset, where we're seeing cancer roughly diagnosed under age 50. We see multiple generations affected with cancer. And usually those are the same or related cancers, some of those that I just mentioned. Or maybe you're kind of seeing this multiple generations of leukemia, as an example, which would kind of raise a red flag to say something has to be going on here. We look for really rare things in a family. Male breast cancer is not a common one. You could also think of pancreatic cancer. Ovarian cancer is also rare. And then you also look for certain ethnic backgrounds. So we know that there are certain populations that have a higher predisposition not to develop cancer, but a higher predisposition to carry one of these inherited syndromes, like BRCA or Lynch syndrome or some of these other genetic conditions that we identify through our genetic testing. And then when we identify that those individuals and families have those conditions, what we want to do is then target various parts of their body to keep them healthy and cancer-free, or catch the cancer at a very early stage where it's more treatable. And so that might mean more frequent, earlier mammograms, or even using a different way to screen female breast tissue, which might be with a breast MRI. We might be targeting earlier, more frequent colonoscopies. So instead of doing colonoscopies at age 45 and doing it every 10 years, like everyone else qualifies for, we recommend maybe starting at age 20 to 25 and doing them every year. So those are very drastic differences, as you can tell, compared to what the general population does.
And I think it's great because it's another factor that individualizes our care too, that, you know, a lot of times when you're taking past medical history, yes, then you've got some of these factors that you're like, hey, maybe this is another good option. Or even for the healthcare providers out there that, hey, we're not looking into this enough or making the recommendation often enough to genetic counselors as an option for more so for preventative care versus the reactive care that we see a lot of times in the Western medicine paradigm. And so while we're on that track, any recommendations in how we can be more proactive just as an individual for reducing our risk for cancer?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I would say that, of course, I'm not necessarily the main expert in this area. So always good recommendation to ask kind of your primary care doctor or OBGYN about reducing cancer risk in general. But I usually point patients to the American Cancer Society guidelines. So they have a really nice resource that actually outlines dietary and lifestyle recommendations. And if you want to give me just a moment, I can pull up very specific recommendations here that they have. Usually when you review them, it talks about maintaining a healthy lifestyle. And then, you know, a lot of the next follow-up questions I get are, well, what do you mean by that? Right? Because I know when I was growing up, I was an athlete my whole life. And so I felt like going to practice was enough, right? But if you look at specific length of time of working out or the type of activity, that might vary person to person, right? So me going out and playing soccer, I felt like, well, that was, you know, me working out, and I didn't need to do anything outside of that. But what's interesting is, so the American Cancer Society recommends that you be physically active. And so they actually have specific guidelines for that. So for adults, it says that you should get 150 or 300 minutes of moderate intensity or 75 to 150 minutes of vigorous intensity activity each week, or a combination of these. Getting to or exceeding the upper limit of 300 minutes is ideal, right? So thinking about 300 minutes per week, you can divide that up by how many days you're working out, right? Or you offset it on the weekends. if me as a working parent, I feel like I have to maximize Saturday and Sunday, and maybe during, Monday through Friday, I'm not able to do it as often. And then it also gives information about children and teens where it says give at least 1 hour of moderate or vigorous intensity activity each day, limiting sedentary behavior like sitting, lying down, watching TV, and other forms of screen-based entertainment. So that's just an example of the activity. And then it talks about actually what you should be eating, and gives specific information about what types of vegetables, what you should limit or not really eat, which is red and processed meats, sugar, sweetened beverages, highly processed foods, and refined grain products. So I usually point patients to this resource because I feel not only is it this generalization of be healthy, right? Because again, what does that mean? This actually gives you tangible things to work towards and follow.
And that's wonderful. And I know sometimes those guidelines, yes, they're very vague for people too. So like if people out there aren't sure what moderate to vigorous is, consult a personal trainer, consult a physical therapist, reach out to a nutritionist. If yes, broccoli's, a great vegetable, but it doesn't always work with our gut system either. So yeah, these are very generalized suggestions and it's great to start with. And then if you have individual concerns, that's where we branch out and we have all of these other resources too, which is extremely helpful. And so I've mentioned in previous podcast episodes that our body is an integrative system. So when we're talking about the genetic counseling, and as you've mentioned, you specialize in oncology. So how are you identifying other organ systems at risk throughout these assessments?
Yeah, that's a good question. So usually when I meet with the patient, I'm not sure how familiar everyone is with genetic counseling. So maybe it's helpful for me just to kind of review what it is like meeting with the genetic counselor. But I ask lots of questions. So patients are usually reserved an hour of an appointment time. That might be more depending on how the clinic is set up. And I ask a pretty detailed personal and family history. So it's routine for us to ask about that for every single patient. We ask about any organs that might be removed for any reason. So for women, we might be asking about do they have their ovaries or uterus. We also ask, what type of cancer screening they've had to date. Do they do if they're of age, do they do colonoscopy screening? Do they do breast screening? Do they meet with a dermatologist for a good skin check once a year? Are they doing regular gynae visits or meeting with the PCP? Do they even have a doctor who's helping facilitate all these screenings for them, right? I would say that the lifestyle part usually comes after the assessment. It's not really part of the initial assessment. But then I also ask a very, very detailed family history. Who in the family has had cancer? How old are your individuals in the family? What does your family structure look like? And so one thing in particular as a genetic counselor you look at is if a patient is adopted and we don't have any family history, you can't really use that as part of your assessment to know what they're even at risk for, right? So thinking of how you interpret genetic testing in the context of that is a little bit more difficult. Or a patient who I have in front of me that is a female, but they only have males. They only have sons who had, they had brothers. Mom and dad only had brothers. And if you're assessing for breast cancer, or ovarian cancer, or a female-based cancer, you might not actually see that. So how do you, assess that family? So anyways, in thinking of how we ask all of these questions, I will get a three-generation family history. And then we help facilitate genetic testing if that patient meets what we call national guidelines. If that patient meets national guidelines, then we coordinate genetic testing, usually through a cheek swab or a blood draw. In some rare instances, we have to do a skin biopsy, and we help interpret those results then in how those individuals should be followed. And now that might be great, you have a negative test result, and you don't really have a concerning family history. And so now you should follow general population cancer screening guidelines. Or maybe we identified something on genetic testing that says you're at an increased risk. So we want to do something for you that's different than the general population, and we screen you earlier, more frequently. And then I feel like the area that becomes most common is what we call this familial risk, where we don't identify anything on genetic testing, but this patient still has a pretty striking family history of certain cancers, such as colon cancer, as an example. And then we would say, well, the person sitting in front of me who does not actually have cancer, but maybe has a parent or a sibling with colon cancer, we actually can't let them off the hook, especially if their parent wasn't tested, because why was that parent diagnosed with that cancer? We don't know. So then the person in front of me is recommended to do slightly increased screening, because their risk for colon cancer is about double the general population. So instead of everyone's 4.5% baseline risk, their risk is more like 9%. So we recommend doing colonoscopies 10 years earlier when their relative was diagnosed, or you start when everyone does at 45, and then you do colonoscopies every 3 to 5 years. So the idea at the end of the day with meeting with the genetic counselor is to identify, what is your level of risk? Is it baseline like everyone's? Is it based on family history? Or is it an inherited risk category where it's significantly elevated? And then based on which of those categories, we're going to screen that person and make recommendations. And at the end of the day, it might be some sort of combination in that. But I like to think of genetic counseling as more of a proactive way of managing healthcare.
It's interesting. I had a patient in the clinic not too long ago, and there wasn't really a family history of cancer, but grew up in the 1950s and where they were testing, you know, the atomic bombs and whatnot around World War II. How much does environmental factors come into this as we're talking about, you know, we're getting more research into toxins? How many times are you going to the nail salon? How many times are, do you have mold in the house or something like that? How much does that factor in to what you are screening for?
Yeah. So we definitely ask questions about environmental exposures, but it's still hard to know how much environment plays into someone's risk. Because you could think of smoking and lung cancer, right? You would think every person who smokes develops lung cancer, and that's not true, right? There's many people who never smoke who develop lung cancer, and many individuals who smoke their entire life and they never develop it either. So we really don't know why that is happening. Likely, there's some sort of combination of both genetic and environmental factors. What all of those factors are and some sort of combination to be determined. But I would say that it's when there are exposures, those are always things that I take note of. So then we can follow up in the future once there is enough information available. But right now it's hard to quantify exactly what those exposures are and how they play into someone's individual risk.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you being honest, because there are a lot of unknowns when you're talking to people like, well, why did I start having this pain? There's so many factors that can contribute to this. And when we're talking as practitioners and providers, I don't know. There can be multitude of things that come into this, but this is what we're being presented with at this point in your life. This is a moment in time in what we're reading and giving you the stats on this. And just trying to be as preventative as possible moving forward to improve that quality of life.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like my patient population, you know, is typically the 30 and 40 year olds with cancers that are not supposed to be occurring at those ages, right? There was just there was a group that came out this week. I think it actually might have been the American Cancer Society that actually outlined what their most recent stats are. And the updated information shows how young individuals are getting diagnosed with cancer, and how the trends are seeing younger ages of diagnosis for things like colon cancer or breast cancer, and how common that all is. And those patients usually get referred to me because they're younger than what you would expect. And usually if there's no family history and I order testing for them, we don't identify an inherited cause of their cancer. And when that happens, the next most common question I get after disclosing that is, well, why did this happen to me? And I hate that I can't answer it. I can't give a good answer because I don't know. The only time I can quote unquote blame a cancer on something is if we identify an inherited cause, because that inherited cause means that from conception, that person was at higher risk their entire life because they have some gene change that they inherited from their parents, most likely, that is present in every single cell of their body. And that's why they were considered higher risk and likely why they developed that cancer younger and are likely at risk for other cancers to develop in their lifetime, right? Otherwise, I don't really have a good answer and it makes me uncomfortable. But the good thing about oncology and genetics is that the information evolves very quickly. And I hope sometime in the future, we'd have that information to answer that question for patients.
And what are some of the red flags that you can share with us that would warrant an evaluation or a follow-up with maybe not necessarily you're the first step, but with a primary care physician or someone within their supportive healthcare network already?
Yeah. So I would say that anytime I feel like patients are very attuned for the most part into what your family history of cancer looks like, especially if it's a family that talks about it. So I would say anytime there's a cancer diagnosed under age 50, no matter what that cancer is, it's worthwhile to ask your doctor about. If you kind of see a clustering of cancer in your family where a close relative, and that could be two aunts or an aunt and a grandmother or an uncle and an aunt, and they have the same type of cancer, that should prompt a question to your doctor to say, hey, should I be looking into this? And should I be doing any sort of genetic evaluation for it? And I would say the other thing to think about is, as I mentioned, there are certain ancestry or ethnic groups that have a higher predisposition. One of the most common described one are individuals that are Eastern European, Ashkenazi Jewish. That is not the only population that has what we call founder variants. There's many different European cultures that actually have a higher chance to carry one of these inherited variants. Now, we're not at the level of testing individuals based on their backgrounds or where their family is from. However, that's just information to kind of keep in mind when asking about that within the context of family histories of cancer.
And I think it's huge for people nowadays. You know, everyone's the expert in their own body. As much as we can do with these evaluations, I live with myself. I know how I feel. I know when something feels off. And I think it's important to listen to your gut instinct, and when in doubt, just ask. And if if you don't feel okay with the first answer, okay, then ask to get referred out, you know, out to a genetic counselor or whatnot to be proactive. And I think it's become more and more challenging. We've got so much information out there, and I love when clients come in and they've done their own research, and some of it may be applicable. I mean, you go on the internet and you're like, it could be a cold, or it could be diagnosed with cancer. Like there's a large spectrum, but to each, at least have somewhat of a background or a knowledge base coming in to ask the intellectual questions about it and how that applies to you and applies to your family history, I think is important. And just not getting, not demeaning patients in the meantime, as it is a genuine concern for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of patients that I've met with too, many of them are interested in genetic counseling and genetic testing. I should say more genetic testing than genetic counseling, because I ask so many questions, but more genetic testing. And there's lots of labs out there that do what we call DTC or direct to consumer testing. So you could go online and you can search genetic testing and a bunch of different labs will pop up. And you can order a kit and it'll be sent to your house. So one of the most common places you could think of is 23andMe or Ancestry.com. And one of the things to think about with that is the fine print, right? You're ordering that testing as a patient. You're not a healthcare provider. And how do you interpret that? Is that a legit test or not? Now, 23andMe, if you go to their FAQ page, they actually will tell you that they're not testing for every variant in BRCA, but they kind of market it that we are testing for BRCA variants. And so, you know, I think that patients taking charge of their healthcare and doing that testing and advocating for themselves is always a good step. But I always tell patients, I would rather walk that line with you, and I would rather be, you know, a resource to you. So do that all you want. But at the end of the day, let's still have a visit so we can walk through this together, so I can tell you whether that was a good test or not. Now, because I brought up 23andMe, I feel like I have to explain it a little bit. But, you know, if everyone thinks back to your, you know, high school and college biology classes and remember those Punnett squares with the big A, little A, I always joke with patients, like, you never thought you were going to use that. And here we are talking about it in a real life application. But all of our genes are made up of a code of letters, A, C, G, and T, written over and over again. And we all have 20,000 plus genes we get from our parents, one that comes from mom and one from dad. And men and women carry these genes equally. And there's these subset of genes, for the most part, that are actually supposed to be preventing cancers from developing in our body. So a lot of them are called what they're called tumor suppressor genes. So our genetic testing is actually analyzing those genes and looking for changes in those letters or spelling errors, if you will, that are causing that gene to no longer work because one copy is not doing its job. So almost proofreading a book. So if you look at those changes and you find out that one copy of that gene is no longer working, that's what's leading to a higher risk of certain cancers because there's one gene doing its job, the other one is not. When that person has children, there's a 50-50 chance it gets passed on to future generations, which means 50% chance it's shared by siblings. It's 50% chance it came from mom or dad. That extends to aunts and uncles and cousins. Now, 23andMe looks at a handful of variants in the BRCA genes, but it is not all of them. It is not comprehensive testing. So you could think of this as, I can't remember the exact number of variants that they look at, but almost like they're flipping through to look at, let's pretend it's 50. 50 letter changes in an entire 100-page book. They're only looking at 50 letters in that entire 100-page book. So you can tell that that is not a comprehensive test as if it was when you were ordering a clinically available test. So I would say that for anyone who seeks that out, it's a good start, but it shouldn't be the end point, you know? And it's definitely not as comprehensive because that's just an example of one, you know, two genes in a whole host of genes that we would typically test for. So if there's a family history, again, good place to start, but not probably where it should end.
And as much as we've got the basics, because as you said, we all learn some of the basics in biology, but with the testing, there's so many variables. I'm sure there's a multitude of different tests based on what you're presenting with too. And I wholeheartedly support the counseling alongside of it because you can get a test and you're like, cool, I've got the results. I've got 90% on this test, but like, what does that mean? Like, what are the mistakes mean? You know, when you look at just real life application, you learn a lot from your mistakes more so than what's going well. Yeah. And especially if it's amazing how the human body, there's so much that has to go right and that does go right, but the smallest tweak in the system can just wreak havoc on the body and cause a ton of dysfunction. So when you're working with people, this is like one of those questions on those tests where you're like, answer the best. What's the best answer out of all these? It's, you know, so what do you typically recommend? How many follow-up visits? And I'm sure it's very individualized, but I know with my patients, it can be very overwhelming too. So how much is truly beneficial to really go over results or reassessment too?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, I think that it kind of depends on person to person. So one of the things that we haven't really touched upon yet is how impactful psychosocially cancer is in a family and in a patient, right? So I've met with patients who, if they don't have any cancer, but they've seen everyone around them with cancer, I mean, even just getting to make an appointment with me is such a accomplishment, right? And then discussing it is, you know, very tearful. And I don't know if I want to know this information. Genetic testing is always optional, right? And I'm kind of the middle person who helps order it and interpret it and then facilitate screening. But there's many patients still who are like, thanks, but no thanks. And I need to think about it because this is just too hard for me to actually get this information because I'm already so fearful. It's not a matter of if when I get cancer, it's a matter of when I get cancer, right? So I've had so many patients tell me that before. And I think about in, you know, many of the families that I meet with, so many times there are your own experiences and narratives that come with this, you know, meeting with the provider, just as you probably see in your own clinic. And I think that honoring the patient and kind of where they're coming from is so important in how you assess them that I can't say there's one size fits all, which is also why I love my job. As you can tell, I can talk genetics all day, but I feel like that's why I appreciate so much that I can't take what I took from my morning patients into my afternoon patients because everyone's experience is different. And I think that bringing into what the patient's family history looks like, what their goals are for the session, what they're actually looking for at the end of the day actually impacts what I'm going to do for them, right? Because some patients tell me they have no cancer and they're like, I don't even have a relative that has had cancer, but I had a friend that went through this and I don't want that to happen to me. So can you order testing for me? I've had patients that are like, every single person in my family has had cancer, and the writing is on the wall, I'm going to get it. And I don't want to do testing because I know I'm going to get it no matter what you tell me. And, you know, so I feel like I've seen all across the spectrum. And a lot of it is this personalized discussion about what is the best for that patient, which, again, I can very much appreciate from my own personal experience that I've had. So at the end of the day, I don't feel like there's an easy answer to say, you know, A, B, C, or D. It's very much like working with the patient to figure out where do you meet in the middle? And again, I'm kind of just the third party, if you will, getting the information for the patient and family.
And so if there are people that are kind of on the fence, they're like, I'm not sure I really want to get this because they're nervous on what the results are going to be, but I've been informed to get this or whatnot. What do those conversations look like? Because I know there's a lot of people out there that are kind of in that boat that, oh, I've heard a lot about this, whether it's on the news or family members or whatnot, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure I've hit that point yet, but I don't know enough about it either. What the benefits are and, how conservative those treatments can look versus how aggressive they can look too.
Yeah. And I think that that's a really good question. And I would say one of the most common hesitations for patients to meet with us is kind of this like unknown, right? So there's a website out there that is about geneticcounselors.com. So it kind of walks through what genetic counselors do and what visits look like. But when patients are kind of on the fence, what I always tell our schedulers to let patients know is that meeting with someone like me does not automatically sign you up for testing. So just sitting through and walking through your personal and family history obligates a patient to nothing other than a conversation. The other thing is that in meeting with me, even if there's no genetic testing that might be offered or no genetic testing that's done, we still always make recommendations for the patient based on what their family history looks like. So that colon cancer example I gave at the beginning, right, might be impactful for that patient who is 45 and planning to do their first colonoscopy. And their doctor might say, great, come back in 10 years, unless that person reports that their parent had colon cancer, they actually should be doing it every 3 to 5 years. So that's where genetic counselors come in to help, facilitate screening, even if there's no genetic testing done. The other thing that we talk about with patients is you kind of alluded to is the benefits and sometimes the cons of doing it, right? And just highlighting all of that. So in doing genetic, if someone decides to do genetic testing, one of the common questions I get is about privacy and protection, right? So there's a federal law out there called the Genetics Information Non-Discrimination Act. We call it GINA for short. The genome.gov website actually has a great resource and more information that I could probably articulate about it. But in short, that law actually prevents health insurance and employment discrimination based on genetic testing results. So it's illegal for an employer to ask about that information, deny patient coverage, insurance to charge more for premiums based on that. It's also true if that patient switched health insurance companies. There are, of course, exceptions to that, like military insurance or companies that have fewer than 15 employees who don't follow that. However, it's a really good law to have in place for, you know, majority of patients. The downside is that law does not actually extend to life insurance, long-term care, disability policies. And for a lot of patients I meet with who don't have cancer, but they have a family history, or they're at risk to inherit something that's maybe in the family, when I bring this part up, they're like, wait a minute. What do you mean? So what this means is that that law does not cover any discrimination surrounding them getting, like I said, life insurance, long-term care, disability. So that's the loophole. Those insurance companies are allowed to ask about genetic testing results. What they do with that information is kind of up to them. But anecdotally, I've heard about patients being denied policies. I've heard their premiums getting changed. And so if a patient decides to do genetic testing, sometimes, patients might decide to pursue getting these policies completed and in place before they proceed with testing. So those are some of the conversations that we have with patients. The other thing that I'll add is that as we do genetic testing, there are oftentimes we can find uncertain type results. If we go back to that book analogy, what that means is we found a change in one of the genes we were testing for. but it's unclear if that change is causing a higher risk of certain cancers in that patient or family, or, and this is what's more likely, that it's just what makes everyone different from each other and maybe related to where that patient's family comes from. So majority of the time, it's usually nothing to worry about. But for a patient who says, well, you found this uncertain result and you're actually not going to do anything about it, kind of bothers me, right? I have this family history and now we found an uncertain result and you're just going to forget about it, you know? And I always remind patients, we're not forgetting about it. We still make our recommendations based on family history. But for a patient who feels like that's actually going to bother them, then we kind of discuss what is the appropriate level of testing? How expansive do we make it? Because as we do more expansive testing and we include more genes, then there's a higher chance we can find that uncertain type result. So those are just some of the discussions that we have with patients. And again, at the end of the day, it comes back to a personalized discussion of what's best for the patient and family.
And we're both parents, and it's some of these things can be challenging, especially with the discussion, you know, my parents are going to be 71 this year and I've got young kids. So I think approaching these conversations, I know being a pelvic health therapist, you know, like how I talk to my kids about pelvic health and whatnot can be very different than someone else and what they feel comfortable with. And I know that these conversations can be challenging. So how do you go about introducing these topics as they present to young kids?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there's actually many resources out there that I try to provide patients with. There's actually a really good paper that's in the Journal of Genetic Counseling that's specifically how parents can talk to their children about inherited cancer syndromes if it's found in the family. And it's divided up based on the child's age. So it's appropriate age-based discussions. There's also another resource that I recently identified. It's called Let's Talk, Sharing Info About Your Family Cancer Risk. And it's actually a way for patients to kind of practice talking with their family about it. And so I think that that's one of the other common questions I get is, where do I even start? Whether their family member is their sibling or their child, or, and that child could be any age, or their parents, right? One of the questions I always ask patients is like, have you talked about this in your family? Because the person in front of me is my patient, but technically that three generational family history that I just took is my family, right? Or my patient, I'm sorry. So it's definitely, a different sort of approach, in my opinion, compared to other healthcare professions, because genetics, you are talking about the family. You're not talking about just the patient in front of you. And so, especially if there's something known in the family, I've had situations where I may be meeting with a child whose parent does not want to do testing, but an aunt or an uncle carries it or a grandparent carries it. And one of the questions I ask is, have you told your parent that you're doing this testing? Because your result might actually inform their results. Right? Because the only way for that child or patient in front of me to be positive is if their parent carries it. So those are just family dynamic conversations that are sometimes unexpected and a little bit hard to navigate. But as genetic counselors, I think we try to give resources to our patients if that's necessary or indicated. And I would say that as providers continue to ask patients about family history, because I feel like it's becoming more common, there's likely going to be higher uptake of genetic counseling and testing, just because it's becoming a lot more common and the cost is going way down, that I think that hopefully there'll be more resources available in the years to come.
Yes. And if people are having a hard time talking about these things with families and whatnot too, I mean, as providers, we try to have an open mind to refer out, and we just, I feel like we're very like-minded. We just don't want to leave people hanging. These are very sensitive topics sometimes, or they've been down this rodeo with multiple testing. They don't know where to go. And so we want to be able to provide you with the appropriate amount of resources. And again, you know, through the counseling component of it, hey, based on this, this are my recommendations, and people are going to follow it or people aren't. And you've got to do what's best for yourself, your family, and having everybody in mind. And what we commonly come back to is that biopsychosocial model, where how is it
impacting you from a biological level, psychological level, and the stress that comes with that spiritually, mentally, emotionally, whatnot.
Absolutely.
And then how is that impacting you in society too? And so when, just for everybody out there, when we're looking at these things, it's, we don't have tunnel vision coming into these things either. And I don't want to put words into your mouth, but at least when I'm approaching it, it's trying to take these factors into play. Like when people come in with a chronic pain or they've been worried about something for a long enough time, their personalities can change and there can be a whole change in the presentation that we may not see in one visit, two visits or whatnot. So it is beneficial to share what you feel comfortable sharing as much as you feel appropriate for us to make the best recommendations possible for your individual scenario, knowing that it's not cookie cutter.
Yep, exactly. And I feel like trying to give patients resources, like if there isn't a syndrome identified in a family, many genetic counselors give family letters, right? So it's a de-identified letter that says, hi, testing was done in the family. Here's what was found. Here's how you can go about, getting tested for yourself and meeting with a doctor or genetic counselor, right? So I think that, of course, I always tell patients, don't open any doors that you don't want to on my behalf, right? I am not forcing you to do anything like this. But I think that navigating those conversations are sometimes hard. And I feel like we try to provide resources to the best of our ability. And at the end of the day, I think that whatever the patient thinks best, what's best for them is the best, for the situation.
And more of a personal professional question, when you are seeing people, what is the percentage of people that you're seeing where they are coming into office because they are self-referring versus physician referrals?
It's a good question. So I would say that there's a decent amount of patients that are self-referred. I would say that the majority are still physician referred, but there are a good handful that are self-referred, and it might be because I saw an article and it was, it made me think, oh, I have this family history of cancer. I need to come in and meet with someone like you. Or I did 23andMe and it told me I have a positive result and I need to talk to someone about it. Or my friend had XYZ cancer diagnosed and they met with a genetic counselor and I don't have any cancer, but now I'm really worried I'm going to get cancer because I saw my really close friend go through it. And can you do testing for me? So I think that, there's a variety of ways of patients getting to us. And, sometimes I'll say that I might meet with patients too, because they've had a cancer diagnosis. And historically, when patients were referred for genetic counseling, it was almost, and genetic testing, it was almost like to find a reason for why they got the cancer in the first place. But there's also therapeutic options now too for patients who've had cancer. So it might impact how someone approaches surgery for breast or colon cancer if they have an inherited syndrome. It might impact how someone is provided chemotherapy for certain cancers like ovarian, pancreas, breast or colon cancer, prostate cancer. That also might be true in the situation of undergoing a stem cell transplant. So you might want to evaluate if someone's planning to get a stem cell transplant by a donor that's related to them. You probably want to evaluate if there is an inherited risk or not before you use that donor. So there's lots of reasons, I think, why patients get to us because of providers. But in those situations, there also might be information that someone reads on the internet, and then that's why they seek us out. And we end up meeting with them as a self-referral.
So as we wrap up here, what is one, if you could take one takeaway from this, what do you really want listeners to get from this episode on our podcast?
Yeah. So I feel like family history is always something to appreciate, and it always should be appreciated. And individuals who don't have a family history should also be asking the same question. So asking your doctor about if it's appropriate for you to meet with a genetic counselor, no matter what that cancer in the family looks like, or if you don't have a family history of cancer. I think that as this is becoming more commonplace, we're uncovering that even if someone does not look like their family has an inherited syndrome, we are identifying them. I also think in the families that have a pretty striking family history that even though that individual might feel like it's not a matter of if I get cancer, it's a matter of when. The flip side of it is they test negative and we don't have to worry about them anymore because they don't have what is causing the cancer in the family. So I think appreciating the family history is always important, and asking your doctor questions about meeting with a genetic counselor is important. And I know you said one thing, but one other thing is that you kind of alluded to this before, but you know your body best. So advocating for yourself is always something I tell patients. If you feel like something's wrong, you keep asking those questions until you get the answer that you want.
Well, thank you. I appreciate, I've learned so much information just from today, and I'm hopefully everybody else has gotten snippets of this that they can continue to ask questions. And so what I'll do is I'll put in my show notes some of the resources you've provided, some of your contact information. So if people have further questions, they can reach out to you. And again, I just appreciate you being here and helping educate the community so we can make the best decisions for ourselves and just continue to optimize our lives to what we want them to be too.
And yep, absolutely. Always,
yeah, of course. Let's continue to transform from self-awareness to aware yes.